Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner says he's confident about the passage of health care reform, but he's less optimistic about the situation on Wall Street. This morning, Geithner talked about the bank's role in the financial crisis with George Stephanopoulos on Good Morning America.
They did a huge amount of damage to the country, lost a huge amount of trust and confidence. They need to work very hard to restore that. One of the ways to do that.
You think they get that?
I don't think they get it. I think some banks do, but I don't think all banks get it yet.
What do they need to do to show that they get it?
I think they need to make sure they're doing everything they can to help people who can afford to stay in their homes stay in their homes, help make sure they are lending in communities that need access to credit, that viable businesses that face some increased demand for their products now can get the credit they need.
That's Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. Last week, President Obama also said big banks don't get it, and he called big banking executives fat cats. Yesterday, the president met with executives from some smaller community banks, and he said he hopes that they can increase lending as well. Now, many of the larger banks are doing a decent job paying back the federal bailout money. Citigroup announced rather loudly last week that it is repaying what it owes, but it did not trumpet the news of the massive tax break that it's getting as part of the deal. Joining us is Benjamin Applebaum. He's national banking reporter for the Washington Post. And Benjamin, can you explain this tax break for Citigroup? It certainly was not widely publicized.
No, it was not. It is actually a tax break that they're being allowed to keep. It is a rule that allows companies, when they lose money in certain years and then make money in subsequent years, to reduce the amount of taxes that they pay based on the amount of losses that they experienced in previous years. Citigroup ordinarily would have forfeited that tax break because of the government's sale of its ownership stake in the company. So the government basically saying this rule applies to everyone else at every other moment in time. This is a law. And the government basically said we don't want it to apply to Citigroup in this case, which will be worth billions of dollars to the company.
So is this offered to other banks besides Citigroup?
It could, in theory, apply to a couple of other institutions that got an extraordinary amount of assistance from the government. General Motors and GMAC are the two that are the most likely. But it is likely to be a tax break that only applies to Citigroup.
Huh. Didn't Congress recently approve legislation to make sure that these types of waivers were not unilaterally granted?
Yeah, it's interesting. This is something that came up last fall when the Bush administration waived the same rule to benefit a number of banks, including Wells Fargo when it bought Wachovia and PNC when it bought National City. And Congress came along and basically said, you don't have the authority to waive that rule. We're not happy that you did it. We are closing that loophole. And the administration, the Obama administration, is now coming back and changing the same rule. They're asserting a different basis for their authority to do it. But they're once again returning to this same issue.
And what's their basis for their authority to do this?
Well, the argument is that they were authorized to do it under the bailout legislation that basically empowered the government to do everything necessary to get the best returns for taxpayers. And the Obama administration says that waiving this tax rule will help taxpayers because it will improve the price of Citigroup's shares. The government owns about 27% of Citigroup, and as it sells those shares, it will realize a greater profit.
That's a different kind of logic.
It is a very complicated kind of logic, and not everyone accepts that rationale. I've spoken with tax experts who think it's likely that the government will make less money because they've waived this tax rule, because of the tax money that they are not going to be collecting. So whether or not it benefits the government is controversial. So is the government's authority to do it. Several members of Congress have raised concerns about this latest action. Representative Dennis Kucinich, the Ohio Democrat, who chairs an investigative subcommittee in the House, called it an outrage and said that he plans to investigate.
Now, when we hear this type of language from the Obama administration, that these banks, quote-unquote, don't get it, and at the same time we have these waivers for essentially tax breaks, why the disconnect?
You know, there's sort of two things happening right now. One is that there is a consensus in the administration that banks need help. And the government still needs to help them get healthy, and that in the long run, that will be the best thing for the economy. At the same time, there's a lot of political pressure on the administration to show that it's doing everything it can to increase jobs, to improve the economy, And there's a concern that banks aren't doing their part, and a lot of people are very angry about it. And so in recent weeks, we've heard the president, we've heard Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, we've heard other senior administration officials get out there and use some pretty harsh language in speaking about the banks. But at the same time, what we haven't seen is policies or efforts to really force the banks to change the way they're doing business.
And as we said, President Obama met with community bank executives yesterday. How are they reacting to the call to increase lending and these waivers for companies like Citigroup?
One executive compared the big bank's visit to being called to the principal's office and said that the small bank's visit was like being asked to attend a parent-teacher conference. The small banks are not the subject of anger. The administration views them as at least potentially allies. They didn't cause the economic crisis. The tone of the meeting was not nearly as confrontational.
All right. Benjamin Applebaum is national banking reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Cambodia extradited 20 Uyghurs to China this month, another reminder that China has a substantial Muslim population. The Uyghurs live in the country's western province of Xinjiang. And this past summer, there were riots there between the Uyghurs and the ethnic Chinese. Also, China's come down hard ever since, jailing some leaders, executing others, and restricting Muslim observances in the region. But our next guest says, at the same time, there's a revival of Islamic schools in other parts of China. In the last 10 years, dozens of madrasas, or Muslim schools, have opened in China with women leading this effort, teaching the Quran, Islamic Sharia law, and Arabic grammar, along with Chinese language. So, is there an Islam with Chinese characters? Jackie Armijo is Associate Professor of Humanities and Social Sciences at Zayed University in Abu Dhabi, where she studies Islam in Asia. And Jackie, it's a complicated story that you're telling, where we see restrictions in one province, but a revival elsewhere in China. Can you tell us about that?
I first started doing research on the revival of Islamic education in the 1990s. And as I traveled, I would meet these young women who had graduated, you know, from, let's say, a four-year Islamic college, and had volunteered to set up schools, small schools, you know, mostly for girls, in relatively remote villages. And I was very impressed because, you know, a young person in any traditional society, to volunteer to travel far away from your family, to live alone without people you know, to set up a school is a huge sacrifice to make. And finally, I remember asking somebody, I said, how is it that you're willing to make this kind of sacrifice and live far away from your family? And she basically said, there's an expression in Chinese, educate a man, educate an individual, educate a woman, educate a nation. What she was saying is what I know the World Bank spent millions and millions of dollars trying to figure out. I remember Larry Summers, you know, even concurs with this. It's the only thing Larry Summers and I concur about anything, I'm sure. And that if you're, you know, if you're a development organization, if you want to invest money, your best investment is educating young girls. So what's interesting is here's these Chinese Muslims who are throughout the country making an effort to focus on educating young girls. Because one of the other things that's happened in China recently, which is really unfortunate, is that I remember when I first lived in China in the early 1980s, education was free. And again and again and again, at the best universities in China, I would meet people who came from some small village in the middle of nowhere. But because of the way the system was set up, if they did really, really well in these extremely difficult exams, they could go to the best universities in the country where everything was paid for. Now, they're not allowed to charge tuition, but they can charge fees. And these fees, which to us may seem, you know, quite minimal, really add up to, you know, a lot for a struggling peasant in a remote part of China. So what's happening is in rural China, people tend to have two children. If they have a boy and a girl, if they are going to invest in anybody's education, it's going to be the boy. So what you find is girls increasingly in China are less likely to be educated. To be honest, I suspect impoverished peasants, both boys and girls, are receiving less education today than they were, say, 20 years ago, even though China is a much more wealthy country, but specifically girls. But again and again and again, in the Chinese Muslim communities, they're in a situation where they can offer that. They can pool their resources and offer at least a basic education to the girls, which they might not be able to get someplace else.
And you tell a tale of two schools, one of them founded by a young woman named Salima. She left home to enroll in a Muslim school when she was 16, and she returned to a very poor region to start her own school for girls. How did she do that?
She was able to get 10 mosques. This is a very poor region, but the 10 mosques were willing to pull their resources to help her set up a school. And there were a few people who were, you know, not happy about this in the community, but for the most part, people wanted to support it. And she very quickly attracted a very large number of students. And I think after 2 years, she was already hiring the students who had only been there for 2 years to help her teach even larger classes. The other thing is that it's not simply a matter of getting an Islamic education and studying Arabic and learning about the Quran and things like that. It's learning basic literacy, because what they found is that these girls didn't have a chance to receive any education whatsoever. So they also just, you know, there's basic instruction in Chinese language and math and things like that.
What about cost?
The school mostly depends on the contributions from the community and then from wealthier Muslim communities within the province. These are basically free or very, very minimal tuition.
Now, that's the one school. What about the other school?
The other school was one of the first independent ones that received approval. And the explanation I received as to why it was approved is because it was set up by a bunch of retired school teachers. These were Chinese Muslims who had been school teachers in the regular, you know, public schools. And they had decided to start this Islamic, the kind of a community college. And from the beginning, they decided it was going to be co-educational. It worked really well. And I remember the other thing is for Chinese language literature courses, they decided to hire a Han Chinese who obviously wasn't Muslim. And some of the teachers had a problem with that. But the idea was like, no, we said we wanted the best. So, you know, we're just going to get the best teachers we can.
Is a teacher highly regarded?
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
So it's very different from here.
Yeah, and it's true. I mean, because my kids went to the public Muslim preschool in China and then on to first grade. But I remember when we moved back to the States, their American teachers were like, this is so nice, because they weren't used to kids, you know, sort of
listening.
Teachers are just being, you know, something you can just adore.
Would you say that the schools are almost conservative, or how would you describe them? Can you say that?
Part of it is that the Muslim community I'm most familiar with are the Muslims in southwest China, specifically Yunnan province. And Yunnan province, because it is the most ethnically diverse region of China, It's different than the rest of China in many respects. And one of those things is that women tend to play a more active role. Like when you first arrive in Kunming, you see female taxi drivers. You don't see female taxi drivers in most cities in the United States. You don't see female taxi drivers in most countries of the world. But in Kunming, it's very common. And the other thing you'll notice is men being the ones holding babies. So in southwest China, it really is, I think, unique in a lot of ways. And certainly the Muslims of that region reflect, I suspect, what's true overall, you know, the general population in southwest China. I mean, the men are known, they know how to cook, they know how to do housekeeping. And I have, like, friends who are professionals. They, you know, the husband's a journalist and the wife's a professor. Or let's say they're visiting friends in Beijing and the husband automatically starts to help cook dinner or clean up, and their friends in Beijing start making fun of them, like, you know, what are you doing? I mean, that's a woman's work. Whereas in Kunming, it's considered perfectly normal.
So it's just that particular area.
I think it's that particular area. And I know lots of anthropologists, and nobody's been able to explain exactly why, but it's definitely the case.
We're speaking with Jackie Armijo, who studies Islam in Asia. We're talking about Muslims in China. And when we come back, we'll ask, how has terrorism affected China's Muslims? We'll be back after a break, here and now. Welcome back. We're talking about Islam in China with Jackie Armijo. She studies Islam in Asia, and she's been documenting the revival of Islamic schools in China. She's finding out that many Chinese Muslim students go on to study at Islamic universities in Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, even Iran, and that's despite the fact that the number of Islamic universities in China is increasing. And Jackie, one of the things that must surprise some Chinese Muslims when they travel to the Middle East are the mosques, because as you say, the mosques in China look very different. Can you describe them for us?
The mosques in China, which of course have been there for, you know, over 1,000 years, basically look like Buddhist temples. I mean, they have all sorts of carvings and paintings, and from the outside do not look very Islamic. Of course, once you enter and you see the mihrab and, you know, it's facing Mecca, I mean, everything seems, you know, quite familiar. But from the outside, these really don't look like typical mosques.
When you talk about this revival overall, though, would you say that there's any sort of conservative issue in the education?
Within the schools, I haven't seen that at all. Because the kind of people who want to start these schools to begin with, they're thinking, I think, very broadly about improving society as a whole. What I have found is that the students who studied specifically at Medina University in Saudi Arabia, they are taught in a way that when they come home, they really want to change things. They want to make things more traditional. They want to follow, you know, rules very precisely. It seems to me that these students are inculcated with this sort of like mission to go back home and make things proper. And yeah, so though, but then what I was told recently is that the Saudi Arabia, this particular university, was not accepting as many Chinese Muslim students because so many of them were coming, and once their Arabic, you know, gotten pretty good, they were quitting the program and going to find work, basically as translators for a business. So I thought that was probably a good thing because I mean, this is the kind who come home and want to do things like, you know, destroy a mosque because it looks too much like a temple, even though that mosque has served that community for centuries.
So I wonder what must happen when the men come back to a place where it's more liberal for women.
I've asked, you know, Chinese Muslims there, and they say, well, here it doesn't matter so much, you know, because we have a certain attitude, you know, towards women. But they say, however, in the Northwest, where they tend to have more traditional approaches towards, you know, women's roles. Now, if those students were to go and study in Saudi Arabia and they were to come back, then it's much more likely they would be able to push certain, I don't want to say interpretations of Islam, but certain expectations of women. Traditional Chinese society and traditional Middle East society are really not that different.
And what about in China, primarily? Women are allowed to be imams, is that right?
Not throughout all of China. In central China, there is a history of women basically being imams. In southwest China, they're teachers, and they have an important role in, let's say, in the mosques. In northwest China, in some places, women aren't even allowed in the mosques.
So essentially, it depends on what area of the country you're
in. Right, exactly.
And how women are treated and what their role is, mm-hmm. really, in their mosque. So what about communicating among the Muslim faith? Is there a lot of communication so folks in one area of the country know and could be influenced by what's happening in another country, either becoming more liberal or becoming more conservative?
That's one thing that's always fascinated me, because I remember when they first opened that independent Muslim college I mentioned earlier, the retired school teachers. And this is before computers. This is, you know, before mobile phones. They sort of got the word out that they were going to open this new independent Islamic college. And within months, they had students from all over China, you know, from like, you know, 1,000, 2,000 miles away, from the far northeast corner, from Hainan Island, you know, from Xinjiang. But partly historically in China, one of the things that the Muslims have specialized in is transportation. So in the old days, it was just like a horse cart. And now I think a lot of long-distance truck drivers are Muslim. So I think that was one of the reasons, one of the ways they got information around. But in general, I'd just be walking from village to village, and I'd enter a Han Chinese village, and they'd say, okay, where are you from? You know, okay, I'm American. How much money do you make? You know, they'd ask me things like that. And I walk into a Muslim village, and they're like, oh, okay. How many Muslims are in the United States right now? What do you think of your government's foreign policy? I mean, what, you know, they're just like bombard me with all these questions. And there's this really desire to know about what's going on in the rest of the world. And also, once they find out I know a lot about Muslims in China, they'll ask me about, you know, other regions of China as well. But there's just there's this connection that Muslims in China really do want to know what's happening with Muslim communities, you know, throughout the country. And they travel back and forth enough that they somehow do have, you know, have very, very good idea of what's happening in the rest of China. At the same time, they also want to know what's happening in the rest of the Muslim world.
Many Muslims in this country have said that the so-called war on terror has had a bad effect on them in particular. Has it been the same?
Specifically in Xinjiang, absolutely. I mean, once the United States government agreed that this very, I mean, nobody who works on Islam in China ever even heard of this group, ETIM, the Eastern Turkestan Independence Movement. Once the U.S. government had agreed with China that this was a quote-unquote terrorist organization, that enabled the Chinese government to impose all sorts of policies that were, you know, even more restrictive. So, yes, I mean, I think without a doubt, the Muslims of Xinjiang, specifically the Uyghurs, things have been made more difficult for them. But I don't think that's happened across the board to the other, you know, the Muslims living in other parts of China.
Jackie Armijo is Associate Professor of Humanities and Social Sciences at Zayed University in Abu Dhabi. Thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. You go after us, and we'll wipe out your family. That seems to be the message in Mexico, where relatives of a Marine were slaughtered after his funeral this week. The Marine, Melquisedec Angulo Cordova, was honored with an elaborate memorial ceremony after he was killed in a huge drug raid in a suburb of Mexico City. Also killed in the raid was Arturo Beltran Leyva. He is one of the country's most notorious drug lords. But just hours after the Marine's burial, his mother, sister, brother, and aunt were gunned down in their home. Tracy Wilkinson is Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. And Tracy, there have been more than 15,000 drug-related deaths in Mexico in the last 3 years. But these murders are so shocking. How are people reacting?
Mexicans are horrified, and you would think perhaps on one level at this point nothing can shock, but that's not true. There's sort of an unwritten code that there used to be an unwritten code that you don't touch the family. That has gone away, and often children, siblings, even occasionally a wife might be killed. But to kill the mother is really unheard of in this country and in this drug war.
So what does this signal then to folks about what might be happening in terms of strategy on the part of the drug cartels?
It signals the cartel saying, as you mentioned, that, you know, if you go after us in a spectacular way, we will hit back in unprecedented ways. And that's what they've done. As one analyst told me, the wrath of the Beltran Leyva family. And this is clearly revenge being taken on his part.
So tell us a little bit about him and why he was such an important target for the government.
He had been part of the most powerful drug cartel based in Sinaloa, sort of the center of drug trafficking in Mexico. He had split with other members of that cartel and was running one of the most violent, ruthless groups fighting for territory all around the country, including just south of Mexico City, and making important gains there.
Well, what does it look like when a major drug lord like that has made inroads? What's it like there?
Well, it means that he's corrupted part of the police force, if not all of it. He clearly has members of the local government on his payroll. It was interesting to me that he was holed up in one of the most distinctive high-rise apartment buildings in Cuernavaca. So it's not like he was in some, you know, hidden away villa behind high walls. He was in the most luxurious, notable building in the city. So clearly he had protection at some official level.
So if we go back to the Marine for a moment, why, if the Mexican government knew that it was dealing with such a notorious drug lord who, you know, was well protected, why make this funeral for the Marine such a spectacle, a public spectacle?
That's a good question, and obviously there's a lot of soul searching about that today. The government was very happy to have killed Beltran Leyva. It was a very important victory in their very troubled drug war, and so they were eager to celebrate it, and unfortunately they did not take into consideration, or they failed to adequately analyze what might happen to the family. Again, it is such an outrageous act. I guess maybe they could be forgiven for not predicting it, but still, there's some question about, did they go too far in sort of honoring and publicizing this Marine and his family.
Mm. Now, Mexican President Felipe Calderon, he did condemn the killings, but says he is going to continue with really what's become a military offensive against the drug cartels. I think there's something like 40,000 troops now fighting the drug cartels in Mexico. Doesn't seem to be stopping anything, though. Is there any sort of light of success here in what the government's been doing?
Well, the government argues that the very high level of violence and killing is somehow a mark of success, that it shows that they are hitting hard at the cartels and the cartels are hitting back. There aren't a lot of people in Mexico who would necessarily agree with that they are winning this war. I think public opinion is sort of divided, but when a family of a Marine is killed, it really changes the dynamic of the debate, and I think it's going to have a lot of repercussions in terms of public opinion and questioning about the government strategy.
Tracy Wilkinson is Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Tracy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And we're back after a quick break with a doctor who studies how to live to be 100. It's Here and Now. Welcome back. Senate Democrats say they have the votes to push through health care reform with a final vote expected tomorrow. But what happens to health care costs if people start living longer? A UN study projects that the number of people living to 100 worldwide will top 2 million by 2050. Dr. Thomas Pearls, director of the New England Centenarian Study, says more centenarians will mean lower health care costs because you have to be healthy to live that long. So, how do you live to be 100? Last year, we posed that question to him, and here's his recipe.
It's my belief that most of us should be able to live well into our late 80s with good health behaviors. We learned this from the Seventh-day Adventists, which is this religion that dictates certain health behaviors. As a group, they are vegetarian, they regularly exercise, they don't really overdo anything, including eating, so that they tend to be lean. They don't smoke, and they spend a lot of time with family and religion, which translates probably into managing their stress very well. And lo and behold, they have the highest life expectancy in the country of 88 years. Now, granted, maybe you don't have to be vegetarian, but I do think walking every day for 30 minutes a day, eating in moderation, certainly not smoking, are really key factors. And the centenarians are uncanny in their ability to manage stress well. And all these things come out in this life expectancy calculator that I have at livingto100.com. And people can go on there and answer about 40 questions, and out will spit their life expectancy with, of course, a money-back guarantee.
You know, I noticed some interesting things on there. For example, you ask whether people floss their teeth, whether they take supplements with iron. Why are those important things?
Gum disease, which is inflammation of the gums, harbors bacteria and inflammatory substances that get spewed out into the bloodstream. And those very same bacteria in your gums are actually found in the plaque of the blood vessels that feed your heart, which leads to what's called coronary artery disease and ultimately heart attack. With regard to the iron that you asked about, 85% of centenarians are actually women, and only 15% are men. And there's this long-held question about why women win the longevity marathon. And there had been thoughts about estrogen. But another really interesting idea is that women menstruate for about 45 years or so. And as a result, they're relatively iron deficient. And it may be that iron deficiency that's a real advantage, in that iron plays a really important role in our cells' ability to produce these free radicals, which are these very damaging molecules and atoms that glom onto our cell membranes and our DNA that probably play a really important role in aging.
So women would have a diminished capability to produce the free radicals.
That it may be as simple, though I doubt it, as less iron means less free radical production.
But you put some stock in it, obviously. It's in your calculator.
It is, and I've actually been quoted in some very strange places where I say that I purposely try to menstruate every 8 weeks. And the way I do that is I go to the Boston Medical Center blood donor room and donate a unit of blood every 8 weeks. Now, I do that in part because I have a pretty rare blood type.
You also, in your calculator, give folks recommendations about how they can increase their life expectancy. And so they typically are some of the big ones. If folks smoke, they should stop right away. What are some of the others?
Bodybuilding for the brain. These would be things like doing Sudoku and Scrabble and Bridge and other games. The key is that once you get good at them, you either go up a level or you do something entirely different. The biggest heavyweights would be learning a new language or a musical instrument.
Let's go back to your centenarians for a moment. What do they have? Is it luck? Is it genes? What is it?
The most dramatic finding is that this runs very strongly in families. So, for example, if you look at the brothers of centenarians, the brothers themselves have about an 18 times greater chance of living to 100, and the sisters of centenarians have about an eight times greater chance.
Tell me about the man who lived to be 103, even though he was a heavy smoker, into his 90s, and drank 3 martinis a day. What's going on in this case?
People like this are very rare. I can probably count on just the fingers of one hand. How rare we find individuals who've basically thrown everything equivalent to an atomic bomb at themselves, and they're still doing very well. And this man not only had those horrible habits, he was completely cognitively intact. When I went to see him, he was repairing his roof. It was phenomenal. And he had said that he had stopped smoking in his early 90s because he started thinking living to 100 would be cool. But he continued the 3 martinis a day. Men like that man and also our super centenarians, people who live to 110 and older, I think are the ones that really hold the secrets to what's really our holy grail, which is the longevity-enabling genes.
What about the pills that are now on the market that claim to help with longevity, like a human growth hormone pill that we hear about or different supplements?
So that's all pure quackery. There is no substance out there that anyone can sell where they can claim that it stops or reverses aging. And growth hormone, if they are trying to sell it as a pill or as a spray, it might as well be eating sand or drinking water, only because if that was growth hormone, it could never get into your system by those routes. The only way growth hormone works is if it's injected. And for those who fall for the claim that injectable growth hormone stops or reverses aging are completely being taken for a ride. It is pure quackery at best and downright dangerous and unethical at worst.
So then, I hate to even ask you, might we be able to one day take a pill that would help, increase longevity?
Scientists and the pharmaceutical industry are working on drugs that are more related to age-related diseases. If there's something they might do to the baseline rate of aging, the likely impact of that is not so much getting people to much older age, but to try and decrease their risk for age-related diseases, primarily heart disease, stroke, and diabetes, maybe cancer. That I foresee happening over the next 10 years.
So folks who say this is just a bunch of baby boomers not wanting to die and the world can't handle all of these people, you would say what we're talking about here is really quality of life, and it would actually be less expensive in the long run because we're talking about reducing disease.
That's absolutely right. Centenarians are a group that, again, they markedly delay disability towards the end of their lives. They're among our least expensive in terms of age group. When it comes to healthcare, I am a very strong optimist when it comes to aging, and I believe in this notion of not anti-aging, but aging well. And the vast majority of people, like Seventh-day Adventists, should be able to live almost 30 years beyond the age of 60 with very good quality of life.
Dr. Thomas Pearls is director of the New England Centenarian Study. To try out his life expectancy calculator, go to our website, hereandnow.org. And up next, the young voices of a high school madrigal group. We'll be back in 1 minute, Here and Now. Welcome back. On a brightly lit stage in an empty auditorium, 20 high school students gather in a wide arc, all eyes on a red-haired young woman at the center. She begins to sway in time, making a rhythmic tapping motion of forefinger to collarbone, silently mouthing the first words of a 6-part English madrigal. These are the madrigal singers of Belmont High School in Massachusetts, rehearsing with choir director Sean Landers. They're preparing for their performance as the centerpiece of the 35th annual Belmont Singerama, in which choral groups from all the town schools perform. Here and Now's George Hicks followed the madrigal singers during their busiest week of the year.
My name is Isaac. I'm a senior. Choral music I originally got interested in because at my church we would always be singing and there would be different harmonies, so it was a lot of fun and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, I'm in the same church as Isaac, and they start us singing when we're 2 years old. It really gets us interested in doing music, so we like to keep on doing that in school.
In the elementary schools in Belmont, everybody does music, so once I got up to fourth and fifth grade and we did more choral, I found it really fun, so I just kept doing it throughout middle school and now in high school.
Tongues and old spring and sing and old cling and fa la la la, fa la la, fa la la. tanzen und springen, singen und klingen, fa-la-la-la, fa-la-la, fa-la-la. Lauten und Geigen, so laut wie Schweigen, so musizieren und jubilieren, stellt mir an mein Sinn. Fa-la-la-la, fa-la-la, fa-la-la, fa-la-la-la, fa-la-la, fa-la-la. Schöne Jungfrauen in grüne Augen.
I'm Sam, I'm a senior. When I was younger, like a freshman or sophomore, I looked up to the people in Madrigals because I saw them as leaders, and that kept me interested in music.
Yeah, I remember being in like sixth grade and noticing the Madrigals because they were the costumes of the period and they sing.
It's like the most selective group. When I was younger, I aspired to be in the Madrigals.
Good,
you guys
are going to
have a great set.
My name is Sean Landers, and I'm the director of choirs at Belmont High School. The students in this school are just so great to work with. They're so high achieving and they're so focused, and you know, they take languages and you just have to give the pronunciation to them once and they've absorbed it, and you know, they really work at a very high level, so it's really an enjoyment to work with this group.
Okay, so can you get to your mixed arc, please, in the second row? Madrigals, mixed arc, second row.
One of the pieces that the students are performing this season is Sicut Locutus Est by Johann Sebastian Bach. It was originally written for a Christmas Eve service, and it's loosely translated to mean, "Thus it was spoken to our forefathers, Abraham and his descendants, unto eternity."
We're going to start over one more time. And real quickly, can everyone just jump up and down 10 times? Go and count with me. Go.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Now do jumping jacks. 10, go. And 1.
Well, the rehearsal process is always somewhat organic. You go in there with a plan, and then you encountered very low energy, and this was having an effect on the pitch. So we had them doing some jumping jacks and jumping up and down, and that's sort of a subconscious trick for them because it engages them on a different level, because it's, you know, it's silly. They're in class and now they're doing jumping jacks in the middle of rehearsing this piece by Johann Sebastian Bach.
Sicut locutus est ad patres nostros, sicut locutus semini est ad patres nostros, sicut locutus semini est ad patres nostros, sicut locutus semini est ad patres nostros.
Every year we get a lot of new additions to the group as kids graduate, and I think how well we sound has to do with how dedicated those people are and how willing those of us who've already been there are to help.
I'm Robbie, I'm a sophomore. This is my first year, and we start out rehearsing in parts, like all the basses together, all the tenors together, so that helps you hear your part and learn it. And then once we've learned most of the music, we start singing mixed, and you kind of listen to people around you and you just try and blend with them.
Perform at a festival called MICA, which is the Massachusetts Instrumental and Choral Conductors Association.
This MICA festival, Madrigal Singers got a gold medal, which is the highest.
And Belmont High School as a whole got 5 gold medals for each of our 5 groups, which is, I think, the highest amount of gold medals that anyone has gotten in the history of the competition, which is pretty cool.
Make sure you're all watching Leslie to start off, just so that we're all on the same page in terms of tempo. And as soon as Gary plays the pitch, make sure you're locking it in. Okay?
Geboren ist uns der Heilige Christ, der alle Welt auch ein Tröster ist.
I'm Leslie, I'm also a senior. I'm the student conductor of the Madrigals, and basically my job is to set the tempo and bring everybody in together so we're all starting at the same time. And I I kind of bob my head or tap my foot in order to indicate tempo changes and stuff. So if we ever have a difficult part of the song, everyone's heads will all of a sudden turn to me and watch me for our cues and such.
And Leslie also mouths the first few, like the first line of the song, and tells us when to breathe, which is very helpful for coming in on time.
And then everyone else, as soon as they see her, will start moving additionally. So there's kind of like a swaying that we have.
We'll try to become one body, I guess. I'm Gary. I am also a senior. In the Madrigal Singers, we sing early music from the Renaissance. Then during Christmas time, we do carols.
And I know singing carols is sort of against the definition of madrigal groups, because madrigals traditionally sing early music that is secular, so we sort of break the rules a little bit.
I'm Emily. I'm a senior. I think the group just kind of lends itself to being able to travel around town caroling, because we're small and we sing a cappella. We're known throughout the town.
December is a very, very busy month for the Madrigals because we have caroling gigs 3 times a week on average.
Every day was either a mall or a hospital or something.
We're definitely recognized by our town because we go to all these events every year and the town loves it, and that's how the town identifies us. We're definitely an icon in Belmont.
Our story on the Belmont High School Madrigal Singers was produced by George Hicks. There's more of their music on our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again tomorrow, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.